I suspect, or at least I guess I should say I hope, that all of you realize that today is April the 14th, which means tomorrow is the 15th and tax day. And I imagine that I hope, that you've been able to prepare for that and to finish whatever you needed to finish so that you can get that taken care of in a timely fashion. I don't expect that anyone here would think that if tomorrow comes and the tax day comes, that we could say to the government, I just got busy and I couldn't get around to it and I was unable to complete them. And we understand that there are just some things in life that are of such an importance and of such a priority that they have to be done. And they can't be avoided, they can't be neglected or ignored. And as much as we might wish they would go away, they're not going to go away and they have to be dealt with. And there are many things other than taxes that fit into that category, and actually many things more important than taxes that fit into that category. But the ability to identify those things that are important like that is quite a significant task in life. We've got to be able to identify the things that are of priority, that we need to address and that we cannot put off and we cannot delay, we cannot neglect, we cannot ignore. They have to be confronted and dealt with. And there is no greater example of one who did that than Jesus himself, as is true in every regard. He is the greatest example. For that very reason, the scriptures speak to us about the fact that we are to follow in his footsteps. He is our example, that we should follow in his steps. I want to talk to you tonight about Christ's characteristic of being unhindered, of being one who could not be delayed, who could not be put off, even though many people tried to delay him and to convince him to put aside certain tasks. He could not be convinced to do so in many, many important ways. And I'd like for us to give some thought to that example of Christ and then to consider how it ought to be a characteristic of our own. If you turn to the Gospel of Matthew in the third chapter, we read about a familiar event in the life of Jesus. Matthew chapter 3, we'll begin reading in verse 13 as it records the baptism of Jesus, which is oftentimes identified as kind of the beginning of his public ministry and how he went from this point on to publicly declare the gospel of the kingdom and to go on for the next 3.5 years in his preaching. But verse 13 of Matthew chapter 3 says that Jesus arrived from Galilee at the Jordan, coming to John to be baptized by him. But John tried to prevent him, saying, "I have need to be baptized by you, and do you come to me?" Now notice, what did John try to do? He tried to prevent it. He tried to hinder Jesus' doing this thing, thinking that it wasn't appropriate for him to baptize Jesus, but in fact, rather, that it was more appropriate that Jesus would baptize him. Verse 15, however, says that Jesus answering him said, "Permit it at this time, for in this way it is fitting for us to fulfill all righteousness." Then he permitted him. That is, then John permitted Jesus this request. And he participated and he assisted as he could. Verse 16 goes on to say that after being baptized, Jesus went up immediately from the water. Behold, the heavens were opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending as a dove and coming upon him. And behold, a voice out of the heavens saying, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. Jesus, at least at the outset of this event, was made by someone that he trusted, by someone that he had respect for and esteem for, tried to prevent him from doing what he knew he should do. Of course, the scriptures go on to tell us about Jesus' respect and his esteem for John. And he talked about the greatness of John on future occasions. But I just want us to take note of the fact that when even someone who was held in high esteem tried to prevent Jesus from doing what Jesus knew needed to be done in order to fulfill all righteousness, Jesus refused to be hindered. But this isn't the only occasion in Jesus' life when the attempt was made to hinder or to prevent him from accomplishing what he sought to accomplish. Turn, if you would, to the Gospel of John. And in John's record of Jesus' life, he tells us in the 7th chapter of how family members attempted to prevent Jesus. John chapter 7, in verse 3 and following, his brothers therefore said to him, Depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples also may behold your works which you are doing, for no one does anything in secret when he himself seeks to be known publicly. Notice the phrasing here. If you do these things, that is the miracles that he had been performing, the great works he had been accomplishing, if you do these things, so show yourself to the world, for not even his brothers were believing in him. Jesus therefore said to them, My time is not yet at hand, but your time is always opportune. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify of it that its deeds are evil. Go up to the feast yourselves. I do not go up to this feast, because my time has not yet fully come. I find it interesting that here these brothers of Jesus, who the text tells us did not even believe him. They didn't believe in the things that he was saying of himself or about himself. They didn't believe, apparently, even the deeds that he was performing. They had doubts about them. Or else they would not have said, if indeed you do these things. Their advice was purely on the basis of advising someone who they considered to be wanting public attention, that if you want to attain a general knowledge and a general support from the crowds, here's the public relations advice that we have for you, brother. You go up to Jerusalem. It is further, I think, established by Jesus' response to these brothers that they really didn't believe him, and he knew that. When he says to them, My time is not yet at hand, but your time is always opportune. I want to tell you something. The people who would hinder you and me from the doing of what is right, their time is always opportune. They will always be present. They will always be active. Jesus says their time is always opportune. But then he goes further to really describe this separation between himself and his brothers at this time. Verse 7, where he says, The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify of it that its deeds are evil. Why couldn't the world hate his brothers? Well, essentially because his brothers were in agreement with the world. His brothers were on the side of the world when it all came down to the bottom line. The world hates me, Jesus said. Why? Because I testify about it. I tell the world what it is. I identify it for what it is. Well, his brothers were part of it. At this point in time, thankfully, that would change. But at this point in time, they didn't believe in it. And so they sought to hinder him. I'm thankful that Jesus would not be hindered by people that he held in high esteem. He would not be hindered by those that were the closest to him, by his own family. But nor would Jesus be hindered by religion. And I'll tell you what, religion is one of the greatest hindrances to the things of God. Look, if you would, in the Gospel of Luke, in the 11th chapter. Luke records events surrounding one of the many times that Jesus found himself in conflict with religious leaders of his day. We'll begin in verse 42, where he says, "Woe to you, Pharisees, for you pay tithe of mint and rue and every kind of garden herb, and yet disregard justice and the love of God. But these are the things you should have done without neglecting the others. Woe to you, Pharisees, for you love the front seats in the synagogues and the respectful greetings in the marketplaces." I'm glad to see we don't have any Pharisees with us tonight. That's one thing about the brethren. Boy, they're never going to be accused of wanting the front seats. Well, he goes on and he says, verse 44, "Woe to you," still speaking to the Pharisees, "for you are like concealed tombs, and the people who walk over them are unaware of it." The significance of that is that to come in contact with a tomb would be to make a Jew defiled, unclean, ceremonially unclean. But they wouldn't even know it because the tomb that they've come in contact with was unmarked. What they would normally do is they would whitewash where a tomb was made so people would know there's a tomb there. But if it's unmarked and the Jews come in contact with it, they become ceremonially unclean, not knowing even that they had such a spiritual problem under the law. But notice what he compares this to. He compares it to the Pharisees. They don't appear to be ungodly people. No one would expect, generally speaking, among the Jews, no one would expect that these were dangerous men who might lead them astray and might cause problems for them spiritually. Jesus says that's exactly what you are. Now then, verse 45, "One of the lawyers said to him in reply, 'Teacher, when you say this, you insult us too.'" The lawyers were not really legal advisors or counselors as we would think of it. They were really more like preachers, if you really want to know the truth of the matter. They were considered to be, quote-unquote, experts in the law. And so this man speaks up and says, "Well, we're offended by this as well, by what you've said to the Pharisees." And he said to him, "Woe to you lawyers as well. For you weigh men down with burdens hard to bear, while you yourselves will not even touch the burdens with one of your fingers. Woe to you, for you build the tombs of the prophets, and it was your fathers who killed them. Consequently, you're witnesses and approve the deeds of your fathers, because it was they who killed them, and you build their tombs. For this reason also, the wisdom of God said, 'I will send to them prophets and apostles, and some of them they will kill, and some they will persecute.'" See, you're going to behave just like your fathers did with the prophets. "In order that the blood of all the prophets shed since the foundation of the world may be charged against this generation, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who perished between the altar and the house of God. Yes, I tell you, it shall be charged against this generation. Woe to you, lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. You did not enter in yourselves, and those who were entering in, you hindered." Here were individuals who Jesus said were actually experts in being hindrances. They did this by, in his description, removing the key of knowledge. They took the knowledge of what God expected from people, the knowledge that was attainable through the law to the Jews. They removed that. They removed it by not applying it as they were charged with applying it, and by adding to it things, their own opinions and the opinions of esteemed teachers, adding to it human doctrines. But by doing this, they removed the key of knowledge from people. I want to tell you, Jesus was not gentle. He was not tiptoeing around. He was not trying to be politically correct when he leveled his attention to religion of his day. He would not be hindered by it. Not by the most respected and influential of the leaders among the Pharisees, not by the quote-unquote experts in the law. He would not be hindered. And we ought to thank God for that fact, that he had that quality. But I'll tell you what else Jesus did not allow to hinder him. Jesus didn't allow Satan to hinder him. We won't take the time to read it in its entirety, but Matthew, the 4th chapter, and the first 11 verses is the familiar account of Jesus as being tempted by Satan. He was led up by the Spirit, verse 1 says, into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And he fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and then he became hungry. And it's, of course, at that point of perceived weakness that the tempter comes and says, if you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. And you know the account, how it goes on, with two other attempts on this occasion by Satan to tempt Jesus. If he had succeeded, what a victory for him. He would have hindered fully and completely God's plan for redeeming man. God's purposes to provide in Jesus the perfect sacrifice for sin. That would have all been destroyed. Isn't it interesting, though, how this begins? That Jesus then was led up by the Spirit in the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. It was for that purpose that he was led there. What would you have done? Put in his place. Well, I don't want to go. Where's the wilderness? I'm going that way. I don't want to go there. I don't want to experience that. It's unpleasant. It's a difficulty. It's a hardship. But Jesus was willing to be tempted. He was willing to face this and would not be hindered from it. And we do Jesus an injustice if we think that this is the only occasion when this kind of thing happened. Luke's record of these events in Luke chapter 4 and verse 13, he concludes this record of Jesus as being tempted in the wilderness by saying that Satan left him then until an opportune time. Remember what Jesus said to his brothers? Your time is opportune. This is your time. Satan will always find the opportunity. He will always find the opportune occasion to tempt us, just as he did Jesus. But Jesus would not be hindered from accomplishing his purposes. And we can thank God for that. Mark, the 16th chapter, tells of another occasion. Matthew, the 16th chapter, tells of another occasion when Jesus would not be hindered. And it, too, is a familiar account to many of us. Verse 21 says that from that time, Jesus Christ began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised up on the third day. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord. This shall never happen to you. But he turned and said to Peter, Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me, for you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but man's. I'll tell you what else Jesus would not be hindered by. Jesus would not be hindered by his own disciples. He would not be hindered by those that he esteemed and accounted as his friends. Here we find Peter trying to convince Jesus, who now has his mind and his eyes set on Jerusalem. He's ready to lead this band of disciples there to face this climactic event in his life, to suffer at the hands of the elders and the chief priests, to die and then to be raised again. The time has come for him to do this. And it would not be an easily accomplished feat, but he would not be turned from it. How often does it take just a word or two of a friend to turn someone down the wrong path? How many times do you read in the scriptures of where someone says something? Ammon, for instance, one of the sons of David, the Bible says, had a friend. And that friend gave him advice. Ammon had fallen in love with his half-sister. She would not return his affection. But Ammon had a friend. And his friend's advice was, well, pretend like you're sick. And when she comes in to take care of you, you take her. You take her by force. And that's what he did. It eventually led to his death when her brother found out what Ammon had done. And he killed him. But when those consequences of Ammon's deeds had to be faced, where was his friend? No mention. And that's what happens a lot of times. It's just a word or two of some person esteemed to be a friend, and down the wrong path we go. We're hindered from doing what we know is right. And then when the tragic consequences come, there we stand, no sight of the friend. Jesus would not be deterred, not even by his friend. I'll tell you another thing that Jesus would not permit to hinder him from accomplishing his purposes. Turn to Matthew chapter 26. And there in Matthew chapter 26, you'll read of Jesus going to a place called Gethsemane, verse 36 says. He instructs his disciples to sit at a certain place while he went over aside from there in order to pray. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be grieved and distressed. Then he said to them, My soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch with me. Now, verse 39 is the verse I want you to look at. It's familiar to you. He went a little beyond them and fell on his face and prayed, saying, My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not as I will, but as thou wilt. This is a little further on in that story, where we read in Matthew 16 where Jesus turned his attention to Jerusalem and he began to prepare his disciples for what he must endure there. Now the story has progressed even farther. He is right on the verge of being arrested and taken and eventually crucified. And he's aware of it. And he prays. He knows what's coming. He prays if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done. Jesus would not even allow death to deter him or to hinder him from doing what he knew he must do. This is a verse that I think poses some challenges to us to understand and to apply correctly. I think probably most of my life I have heard it applied as being Jesus praying to escape death. Let this cup pass from me. But giving himself over to the Father's will, saying, nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done. And if it is your will that I must die, then I am willing to die. Another suggestion that has been made, and there may be many others as well, but another suggestion that I think may carry a bit more weight, at least with me anyway, it does, is that Jesus is not praying to escape death here. But he is praying to escape the severity of the death. And that God answers that prayer. As you read on in the record of Jesus' crucifixion, you know, he was on the cross only for a few hours. It was quite common that crucifixions would last for many hours, even for days, before the victim would die. And as a matter of fact, the gospel accounts record that when the news was brought to Pilate that Jesus was indeed dead, he was surprised because it had only been a few hours. And the idea is that Jesus prays that the severity of this death might be avoided. Not that his death be avoided. That's what he came for. Matthew the 16th chapter, that's what he was preparing his disciples for. Did Jesus face death any less resolutely than Stephen did in Acts the 7th chapter? I don't believe he did. But his prayer was that the severity of it might be avoided. And it looks to me like God's answer is yes. As severe, as shortened as it was still severe. I'm not minimizing what he suffered and what he endured. But he didn't hang on the cross for many, many hours. He didn't hang on the cross for days. But it was a relatively few hours before he expired. But the point I want us to see is that whether it came in days of suffering on the cross or whether it came in a matter of a few hours, it still came. Death is death. And he died. And he died willingly. As he would say in the Gospel of John, no man takes it from me. That is, no man takes my life from me. I lay it down. He gave it willingly. He would not be deterred from it. He knew it was coming. And he would not be hindered. Not even by what we may consider the uncertainties and the fears about death. Now that's the example that we have of an unhindered Christ. One who would not be hindered by esteemed individuals in his life, by his own family members, by religion in general, by Satan himself, by friends that were closest to him, not even by death itself. So, what hinders you? What prevents you? You know, there was an occasion where essentially that was the question that was asked of one in the book of Acts. Why do you delay? Arise. Be baptized. Wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. Why be hindered any longer, Saul? Why delay any longer? What is it that hinders you? Is it your peers? Is it the criticisms that others might level against you? Is it religion in general? The notion that in general, religion today, as is true throughout human history, has a less than complimentary view towards truth and towards those that uphold truth. Is it Satan? Has he gained such a sway and control in your life that he is able to hinder you from doing what you know is right? Is it those that you consider to be friends? Is it family? Is it death itself? We must remember that the Savior calls us to Him was a Savior who would not be hindered by anything. And following Him requires a willingness to be unhindered in our own lives. Would you take up that challenge tonight? It'll only be done by being unhindered from giving your obedience to what the gospel teaches. That Jesus is the Christ. He's the Son of God. And that believing that, men and women who will turn away from their sins, who will not be kept, delayed, from turning from their sins, and who will confess Christ as the Son of God, and who will be baptized, that these are the ones unhindered by anything from giving obedience to the Lord. These are the ones who become the children of God. If you would become such a child tonight, we encourage you to, while we stand and sing together.